tests. A law must pass before it assumes enough popular authority to be enforced. Thus, the Constitution provides five separate tribunals with veto power. Representatives, senators, the executive, judges, and jury. Every law must be passed by those tribunals before it gains the authority to punish those who choose to violate it. Thomas Jefferson said, "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its Constitution. The power of the jury to judge the justice of the law and to hold laws invalid by a finding of not guilty by any law jurors felt was unjust or oppressive, dates back to the Magna Carta in 1215. At the time of the Magna Carta, the King of England could pass any laws any time he pleased. Judges and executive officers appointed and removed at his whim were no more than servants of the king. The oppression became so great that the nation rose against its ruler, and the barons of England compelled their king to pledge that he would punish no free man for a violation of any laws without the consent of his peers. King John violently protested when the Magna Carta was shown to him, and with a solemn oath protested he would never grant such liberties as would make himself a slave. Afterwards, fearing seizure of his castle and the loss of his throne, he granted the Magna Carta to the people, placing the liberties of the people in their own safe keeping," according to the History of England by Spooner. The Magna Carta was only reluctantly acceded to by the king. Its sole means of enforcement, the jury, often met with hostility from the crown. In the 1660s, English juries were routinely fined for acquitting defendants. In the 1670 trial of William Penn for preaching the Quaker religion to an unlawful assembly, 4 of the 12 jurors voted to acquit and continued to acquit even after being jailed and starved for 4 days. The jurors were fined and imprisoned until they paid the fines. One juror, Edward Bushell, refused to pay the fine and brought his case before the Court of Common Pleas. Chief Justice Vaughan held that jurors could not be punished for their verdicts. Bushell's case, 1670, was a landmark in the common law history of the jury. Jurors continued to exercise their power of nullification in 18th century England in trials of defendants charged with sedition and in mitigating death penalty cases. In the American colonies, jurors refused to enforce forfeitures under the English Navigation Acts. The colonial jurors' veto power prompted England to extend the jurisdiction of the non-jury admiralty courts in America beyond their ancient limits of seagoing vessels. Depriving the defendant of the right to be tried by a jury, which was almost certain not to convict him, became the most effective and therefore most disliked of all the methods used to enforce the acts of trade. John Hancock, the wealthy Massachusetts patriot and smuggler, who as president of the Continental Congress affixed the familiar bold signature which adorns the parchment, the Declaration of Independence, was prosecuted through this admiralty jurisdiction in 1768 for a fine of £9,000, triple the value of the goods aboard his sloop Liberty, which had been previously forfeited. John Adams, his attorney, at later the second president of the United States, eloquently argued the case, chastising Parliament for depriving Americans of their right to trial by jury. Adams later said of the role of the juror, "It is not only his right, but his duty to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court," unquote. Earlier in America, jury nullification had decided the celebrated seditious libel trial of John Peter Zenger. Zenger's case, 1735. Zenger's newspaper had criticized the royal governor of New York. New York law at the time made it a crime to publish any statement, true or false, criticizing public officials, laws, or government. Juries were allowed only to decide if the material in question had been published. The judge was to decide if the material was in violation of a statute. But Zenger's defense asked the jury to make use of their own consciences. Even though the judge ruled that the truth was no defense against the charge of libel, the jury acquitted Zenger. The jury's nullification in this case is almost always praised in history books as a hallmark of freedom of the press in the United States. Thus, by the time of the American Revolution, the jury was considered the judge of both law and fact. In a case involving the civil forfeiture of private property by the state of Georgia, first Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jay instructed jurors that they had, quote, a right to determine the law as well as the fact in controversy. That's in the case of Georgia versus Brailsford, 1794. The role of the jury in preventing government oppression in America was recognized throughout the 1700s. If a juror accepts as the law that which the judge states, then the juror has accepted the exercise of absolute authority of a government employee and has surrendered a power and a right that once was the citizen's safeguard of liberty. Until the middle of the 1800s, federal and state judges often instructed juries that they had the right to disregard the court's view of the law. When northern jurors refused to convict abolitionists who had violated the controversial 1850 fugitive slave law, judges began questioning jurors to find out if they were prejudiced against the government and dismissed any who were. In 1852, Lysander Spooner, a Massachusetts lawyer and champion of individual rights, complained that, quote, courts have repeatedly questioned jurors to ascertain whether they were prejudiced against the government. The reason of this was that the fugitive slave law, so-called, was so obnoxious to a large portion of the people as to render a conviction under it hopeless if the jurors were taken indiscriminately from among the people. Modern historical treatments have praised these jury nullification verdicts for furthering the anti-slavery cause, rather than condemning them for undermining the rule of law and the uniformity of justice. In 1895, the Supreme Court, under pressure from large corporations, ruled in a bitter split decision that courts no longer had the obligation to inform juries that they could veto an unjust law, nor would any officer of the court be allowed to tell the jury of their veto power. Giant, politically powerful corporations had lost numerous trials pressed against labor leaders trying to organize unions and strikes. Striking was then against the law. Juries also ruled against corporations in damage suits and other cases, prompting influential members of the American Bar Association to fear that jurors were becoming too hostile to their clients and too sympathetic to the poor. As the American Law Review wrote in 1892, jurors had developed agrarian tendencies of an alarming character. Despite the court's refusal to inform jurors of their historical veto power, jury nullifications continued in liquor law trials and were a major contributing factor in ending alcohol prohibition. Today in Kentucky, jurors sometimes refuse to convict under marijuana prohibition laws. Which brings us to the current trial of Robbie Brown. But continuing this article, you're listening to Jury Power, an article in the September 1990 issue of High Times, which is a magazine, of course, concerned with marijuana and recreational as well as other kinds of drug use. And we're talking about and reading about the issue of jury nullification. And you are, of course, tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. And I'll be taking any calls as soon as I finish reading this article, which is concerned with the issue of jury nullification, the right of the jurors to say the law is unjust, we say not guilty. Continuing this historical analysis of the issue. In more recent times, fewer instances of jury veto actions have occurred as the courts began concealing jurors' rights and falsely instructing them that they may consider only the facts as admitted by the court. Researchers in 1966 found that jury nullification occurred only 8.8% of the time between 1954 and 1958 and suggested that one reason why the jury exercises its very real power to nullify so sparingly is because it is officially told it has none. California's charge to the jury in criminal cases is typical. Quote, it becomes my duty as a judge to instruct you concerning the law applicable to this case, and it is your duty as jurors to follow the law as I stated to you. You are to be governed solely by the evidence introduced in this trial and the law as stated to you by me. Attorneys for defendants arrested in Vietnam War protests tried to introduce moral and political arguments about the war in order to gain jury sympathy. But jurors were often told by judges that you must apply the law that I lay down, such as in the conspiracy trial of Benjamin Spock in 1969. Jurors receiving such instructions usually convicted while suffering the pangs of conscience. These responses from Spock trial jurors were typical. I had great difficulty sleeping that night. I detest the Vietnam War. But it was so clearly put by the judge. I'm convinced the Vietnam War is no good, but we've got a constitution to uphold. Technically speaking, they were guilty according to the judge's charge. In the few anti-Vietnam War trials where juries were allowed to hear of their power to decide questions of law, defendants were acquitted. Jury acquittals in the colonial, abolitionist, and post-Civil War eras helped advance humanitarian causes and restrain government efforts at social control. Stephen Barkin suggests that the refusal of judges during the Vietnam War to inform juries of their power to disregard the law frustrated the anti-war movement. As Lysander Spooner pointed out regarding the questioning of jurors to eliminate those who would bring in a verdict according to conscience, a practice effectively accomplished today through the juror's oath, quote, the only principle upon those these questions are asked is this, that no man shall be allowed to serve as juror unless he be ready to enforce any enactment of the government, however cruel or tyrannical it may be. A jury like that is palpably nothing but a mere tool of oppression in the hands of the government. That's Lysander Spooner. Those whose interests lie in maintaining government control of social behavior may argue that the Constitution provides all the necessary protection of liberties, but legislatures will always confirm the constitutionality of their own acts, and oaths sworn to uphold the Constitution by judges and public servants have historically been only as good as the powers to enforce them. Nor are free elections adequate to prevent any tyranny without jury veto power, because elections come only periodically and give no guarantee of repealing the damage done. Not to mention the fact that it costs you beaucoup bucks if you want to challenge the existing Republican-type candidates. Additionally, the next body of legislators elected is likely to be as bad as the previous one, since both are exposed to the same temptations and need to use the same tactics to gain office. Further, the jury's veto power protects minorities from the body of the people operating by the majority against the minority. 12 people taken randomly from the population will represent both friends and opponents of the party in power. With fully informed juries, the government can exercise no powers over the people without the consent of the people. Trial by jury is trial by the people. When juries are not allowed to judge the law, it becomes trial by the government. In short, if the jury has no right to judge the justice of a law of the government, they plainly can do nothing to protect the people against the oppressions of government, for there are no oppressions which the government may not authorize by law. Again, a quote from Lysander Spooner, the mid-19th century attorney. 95 years have passed since the Supreme Court ruled to disinform juries, and now it's 100 years. Zero tolerance and the war on drugs have fulfilled Lysander Spooner's 1852 warning. There is no end to oppressions the government will legalize unless the country, synonymous with the jury in the Middle Ages, vetoes them with bona fide jury power. Many states permit passage of laws or amendments to their constitutions by direct votes of the people, the initiative process. In these states, FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association, which is pressing for the Fully Informed Jury Amendment, which is the amendment that says judges have to inform jurors and juries of their right to say no, to judge the law as well as the facts. Elsewhere, FIJA will sponsor educational media campaigns, encouraging lobbying to get state legislatures to reform court procedures and provide assistance at the local level for grassroots campaigns. Jurors everywhere need to be informed of their right and responsibility to judge law as well as fact in court trials. So, the issue here, and I actually thought there was going to be more historical material in here than there is important to us today because we're beginning the trial of Robbie Berlin, who you heard earlier. And if the jurors simply follow the narrow definitions of the law, they may convict this man for essentially engaging in not merely innocent, but beneficial activity, beneficial to himself and beneficial to his community. He may be fined and jailed, and this not merely is a crime against him, but it will again be a chilling and cruel message to the community. And it will, I think, impact all of us if he is convicted. And the possibility that the knowledge of jury nullification on the jury may persuade one or two, at least, of the jurors to say not guilty, in which case, if one juror says no out of 12, there has to be another trial. That's called a hung jury. And so all you need is one vote that stays firm and says no to overthrow the oppression that is going to be happening today in the courtrooms in Santa Cruz. And is that going to happen? I don't know. I myself went before a court in 1994 for an equally preposterous charge, and one that had even less justification. I was charged with serving people bagels and rice, and the jury voted to convict me because they voted along the narrow lines of the law, right, which in this case was a court order, which said that I couldn't serve without permits, even though there was no way to get the permits. And we actually didn't find out all the details of why that jury convicted, but it's people who go into a courtroom as jurors are under heavy pressure to conform, and they kind of, and it becomes even kind of a badge of pride to be able to behave as a sort of a good citizen, where a good citizen is then suddenly defined as following all the rules that the court tells you to follow. It's kind of, it becomes a matter of doing an algebraic equation. Well, is this person violate this particular technical section of this particular law? And people take it on as a kind of a an intellectual challenge, rather than understanding that they are playing with someone's life. It's, I think, at least that's my my analysis. People lose the sense that they are really the ultimate power, that they can, as the citizenry, as the community, make a real choice as to whether to send a woman or a man to jail for violating law if the law is completely stupid or if the law is unfairly applied. They do not have to agree with the judge. They can make their own decision on that. Now, there's some who said, well, if that's the case, you know, then doesn't that mean that if jurors can just do whatever they want, then why can't they just suddenly start convicting even and throw out the whole standard of reasonable doubt? Isn't that kind of a double-edged sword? And the answer that FIJA, fully informed jury amendment advocates like myself and others who favor the rights of jury nullification, and the power of jury nullification, and we not just favor it, it exists. The question is, you know, are people going to be informed of it? The response is that the reasonable standard of doubt which a jury must find, you must be convicted if you're on trial for your life or liberty or even for a fine. If you have a trial, you must be convicted beyond any reasonable doubt, which means it's more than a preponderance of the evidence. It's more than clear and convincing evidence. It's more than strong and substantial evidence. It's beyond a reasonable doubt, which means if there can a reasonable doubt can be raised about your guilt, then you have the right to be declared not guilty. And that's what the jury is instructed to do. Now, jury does not go to this particular standard. At least that's been my understanding. This is not, in essence, this is actually at the core of the jury system. So it is something the jurors, I guess, can't really disagree with on this issue. Maybe we begin to sound contradictory here, because, hey, if they can throw out oppressive laws, why can't they throw out standards that they consider to be oppressive? The answer is that the core of the jury system here is really rooted in certain basic standards of proof and judgment, and that is one that they are not allowed to throw out. And interestingly enough, jury nullification has been used in Southern juries to free racist murderers who, you know, have lynched blacks and other civil rights workers. And that, of course, is the downside of jury nullification. But I frequently, in my experience here in Santa Cruz, felt that jury nullification is really an important power and right to publicize, because there's, particularly because of the drug war, the war on people, that is, people who use drugs, people who use recreational herbs, people whose essentially innocent behavior becomes the basis for the ruination of hundreds of thousands of lives across the country. So if anybody's interested in further discussion of this issue, please give a call to 427-3772. That's 427-FRSC. You're listening to Free Radio 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And I guess I'm going to kind of take a break myself, and we're going to get back to the issue of the curfew, which I continue to rag you about, but I think is really important. We have a couple weeks here. Actually, we have a week and a day before the first reading of the law, the sheriff's law, making it a misdemeanor to tarry if you are under 18 years of age after 11 o'clock at night in the county area. And it's true that the city has rejected this, but I'll tell you, Chief Belcher, whom I spoke to a week ago at the Children's Commission meeting, where the sheriff made a presentation for this law, He's all for the curfew, and if he can get it into the city, he will. He thinks it's a great idea. Well, we had our HUF meeting on this subject. HUF, of course, is my organization, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And I'm going to play you some of the exciting dialogue that went on at that meeting.
Cafe or a restaurant on the 1st of February. Groundhog Day is right around the corner. It's about 9:10, and with me is Gloria and Hoya Ruve and Becky Johnson. Becky is a self-described media slut, isn't that right, Becky?
Well, I was talking about the word slut in general, and I thought that we should embrace the word slut, because what other word do we have, you know? And the way I define it is a slut, male or female, is a person who prefers quantity and variety. So those don't seem like bad things if a person is so inclined.
Well, it's an interesting question. A slut, of course, is a person who has an easy virtue, easy sexuality. Good morning. And the question is then, we're not necessarily talking about a prostitute. We're talking about a just an individual whose sexual choices are, let us say, omnivorous.
Oh yes, a slut is definitely not a prostitute. Prostitute's a whore, right, in common verbology.
And a whore, of course, is a person who sells her or his essential, where sex is considered some essential life choice for money. Although whore is a more broadly defined term, which also refers to someone who sells their time, labor, and integrity for money.
No, if you give it away for free, then you're a slut.
Right.
So, I would like to have a word that didn't have such negative connotations. But
you are a media slut, self-described. I've been called a media slut, but actually my only interest in the media is publicizing certain causes. You, on the other hand, seem to be at every neck of the road, whether it's the metro a week or two ago or in front of the television cameras of Channel 71. Channel 71, is it?
Oh, yeah, I have a new project in the works called The Living Room.
Right.
And
media slut speaking.
Well, yes, I've graduated from Media Locust.
I see. Well, so actually, we've talked a little about your Living Room program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's, of course, due to show up on Tuesday on Channel 71. What actually is the time that the Living Room is due to air?
Well, we were hoping for the time slot directly after Community Perspectives. With
Community Perspectives was the program from which you were unceremoniously dumped, isn't that correct?
where I was dehosted and reconstituted. Yes, that former show, it's fading from my memory rapidly.
It'll be Tuesday at 7 o'clock and the new Living Room show comes on.
Yeah, 7 to 7:30. We had originally planned to have an hour show, but after reconstituting ourselves, we decided to do half hours show.
What is the advantage? I guess this is a naive question that's been answered many times. I haven't heard the answer, but what is the advantage to a television show over radio? I mean, it seems to me that more information is conveyed, maybe simply a different kind of information, through radio, talk radio, speeches broadcast on the radio, and also at a much cheaper cost, and it also seems much more accessible with less setup time required. I have never done much video work myself, but it seems to me that the television is a kind of a homogenized medium where it will be difficult to get out its significant issues in a short amount of time. What do you think about
that? Well, for instance, a person like yourself, you come across very differently on radio than you would on television, just because of your physical appearance. On radio,
for the benefit of our listeners, I have a beard, long hair, and a stout and formidable belly.
You're no Dan Rather.
I'd rather not be Dan, actually.
The world is a perfect place, and Dan's in the right place, and you're in the right place. I love radio. Radio is a wonderful medium for getting the information out, and talk radio, and especially I like radio shows that have callers calling in real time, because there's no way to censor that kind of information, and I'm very much an advocate of free speech, and for, free speech in the 90s, there are just a huge number of channels in which that communication can occur. It's like through the internet or over the back fence. And television is just another medium where you get pictures and sound. Two for the price of one. And I suppose that television as a medium, I mean, we know the couch potato syndrome and the poor guy who's just stuck in front of it in hypnotic daze, doing nothing and just passively taking in information and disinformation alike. But you can have quality programming on television. I don't know if we'll do it on my show, but we're certainly going to aim.
What's the last quality programming you saw on television in the last 5 years, let's say?
Oh, I like the Learning Channel. Channel 41, they have a lot of in-depth historical shows that have included these incredible reenactments. I saw the Mongolian horde reenacted with really literally cast of thousands, all in costume, all on horseback. And
the Mountain of Skulls and something.
It was, that was the Vladimir show.
So actually what we have here is a sort of an impromptu huff meeting between some huffers. So you wouldn't be ashamed to call yourself a huffer, would you?
Well, not official member, I'd say I'm a pro-huffer.
He's a pro-huffer. So we have a huffer, an advisor to huff. I don't know, Gloria, are you a huff member?
I'm a huffer.
You're a huffer. And of course, I am a huffer. There are three issues coming up that interest me for the huff agenda, and of course anything else that people want to put on the agenda is pertinent, or impertinent as the case may be. One is, of course, there's a curfew hearing tonight. Thank you very much. Is that her milk or my milk? Your milk.
Yeah.
One is the curfew. There's a curfew Children's Commission meeting tonight at 7 o'clock at the Human Relations, an auditorium over at the Emmeline Street. And it's going to be a two-hour show, and it's a debate between Eleanor Eisenberg and Sheriff Mark Tracy, with a lot of audience participation. And the point is the Children's Commission will then be making a decision whether to support the curfew and then to give input at the next Board of Supervisors meeting. And I believe the curfew is due to come back on February 13th. And I believe the reason that they have stalled the curfew until that time, or delayed it until that time, is because the Children's Commission does not have its next meeting until a week later. And so they're going to need to wait a week in order to get the input from the Children's Commission after they have this panel discussion with a lot of input. And then the supervisors presumably will do what they want to do anyway and are going to do in spite of what the Children's Commission's voice is on this. The curfew, as you know and as our listeners may know, is a law which makes it illegal for people under the age of 18 to tarry after 11 o'clock at night until 5 in the morning. And there are numerous exceptions to that law, which in the eyes of its sponsors, and unfortunately in the eyes of some of its critics, make that law likely to pass constitutional scrutiny. That is to say, what's called old curfew laws of another generation, which just broadly ban young people on the streets after a certain period of time at night, are considered to be unconstitutional. Thanks. However, the new law, which has certain exemptions and restrictions, is considered okay.
Well, the curfew law, any way you look at it, is making something criminal that used to be legal. And this is a criminalization aimed at only at a specific group, youth. This law will result in people being detained and extra costs in terms of police and jail facilities, court facilities, that sort of thing. The taxpayers will have to bear this additional burden of cost. And it's just another way to make the social service budgets and Justice Department budgets grow a little bigger. Go ahead and support it if you just like giving your money away and making your children's lives a little less tolerable.
Interesting you should say that, Becky. There are two facts that bear on this. One from Attorney Dorothy Weehy, ACLU attorney in San Jose, who I spoke to yesterday and again intend to interview today, and hopefully I'll be able to play that for free radio. One is that $1 million has been spent on the San Jose curfew since it was instituted in terms of increased police, increased enforcement time, and so forth. And
$1 million that could have gone into some sort of a after-school program for youth, for them to have something to do, some sort of quasi-supervision and facilities. I mean, geez, we can't even keep our libraries open 7 days a week. Give me a break.
The claim, however, from Weehy is, at least as she's heard it from the San Jose Mercury News, from the police department, and allegedly from some parents, is that this money has to some extent been well spent because the amount of crime has, if not dropped, it's certainly not increased. I think that the claim is that there has been a drop, or at least that parents are pleased with how the curfew in San Jose is operating.
Yes, there's been a overall crime rate drop across the nation, and this is entirely due, it was predicted, and it has come true, entirely due to the demographics of an aging baby boomer population. We know that the vast majority of crimes, such as burglaries or even violent crimes, are committed by persons between the ages of 16 and 25. As our population ages, there'll be a corresponding drop in the crime rate. It has nothing whatsoever to do with three strikes. We have no evidence that shows that three strikes has had any effect on the crime rate, nor these curfew laws. This is a smokescreen. Go ahead and buy it if you want to be stupid, but that's the real story.
The other fact that was brought up is that, this was brought to me by Sheriff Mark Tracy, whom I spoke to yesterday. He pointed out, as he had pointed out before the Board of Supervisors, there is a state provision which allows the Board of Supervisors to tax parents for costs incurred under the curfew. And he specifically stated that he would not be recommending this, and presumably this county will not be doing this. So he also had no knowledge, or claimed no knowledge, that there was any kind of federal or state program that provided for kind of compensation, for the state, for the police departments, local police departments who institute or are enforcing curfew laws. This was a claim made by Linda LeMaster, as well as someone else, I believe, at the Board of Supervisors meeting when this curfew had a two-hour parade of opponents who spoke against the curfew in early January. But Sheriff Tracy denied there was such a compensatory program as far as he knew. So the issue of money certainly is one issue that is going to be presumably raised by the curfew. Playing devil's advocate here, since the two of us are both opponents of the curfew, I would say probably the three of us here. Gloria, you oppose the curfew?
Definitely.
It has been pointed out by, Catherine Weehy, that, or is it Kathleen? Anyways, Ms. Weehy over in San Jose, the ACLU attorney, that there have been zero complaints to the ACLU hotline regarding violations of civil liberties under this curfew law. Now, this may mean that they aren't doing enough Spanish outreach, since apparently a majority of the people who were stopped under this curfew were of Latino origin. Or it may mean that the curfew is in fact not provoking sufficient hostility or concern, or is being in some way fairly applied so that there are no concerns, or at least no concerns that have been raised to a serious enough level to reach the ACLU's ears. She admits that she, ACLU, has not done much outreach on this, and she apologizes for it. And in fact, I'm hoping today to hear from her about kind of more input from other organizations like the Community Homeless Alliance in San Jose, and possibly, I think there's the Bar Association Public Interest Foundation, which may have some more information. But in a year and a half, or at least, I think it's a year and a half now, at least, of the curfew law's operation in San Jose, there apparently have been no complaints to the ACLU hotline. What do you make of that, either of you?
Maybe there are people that don't have faith in the ACLU process as being a way to address the issues.
Well, what I find in Santa Cruz here, I talk to young people on the street, and in fact, within a block of the very restaurant we're sitting in, Zachary's, and I find almost universal opposition to the curfew law. But, and I ask these people if they're interested in talking on the radio about this or opposing it or organizing, and indeed some of them even give me their phone numbers for that kind of organizational effort, but they don't return calls and they don't show up at the radio station. There's a general lack of interest in combating the curfew. So maybe there's a general sense of ennui, apathy, and anomie that kind of pervades us at the moment.
The futility of speaking out or trying to fight anything, they feel helpless, powerless.
Well, you're not helpless, folks. Keep that in mind. And you can always call in to 427-3772, which is the Free Radio Santa Cruz line, to comment on this ongoing debate, which, by the way, is recorded. But, hey.
And indeed, there are some young people who are speaking out. And here they are. This second recording was made several days later. Actually, perhaps several days earlier. In any case, around the same period. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. If you have any comments on anything you're hearing, you need to give a call. Give us a call to 427-3772.
Individual here on the street sitting on Union Grove Music property, who knows when the police will arrive, who has this comment about civil rights.
I think civil rights are a crock of shit because government does what they want anyways and doesn't really matter because they're just going to go ahead and do what they want. They don't care about civil rights. They don't care about people. It's a bunch of bullshit.
As long as you have that attitude about it, you're never going to get anything done because then you're just going to sit back and let the government do everything and not worry about it and not get involved in it yourself.
Why should I bother getting involved? I mean, yeah, people say one person makes a difference, but that's also a crock of shit, because one person can't make a difference against, like, however many is opposed.
That's not true, though.
No.
If you can get yourself into it, and then you start getting your friends into it, and then your friends get their friends into it, before you know it, everybody's going to be doing what you're doing, you know, and helping stuff out. That's why I get in this argument all the time with my girlfriend, because I was in the military and she hates the government so much. But I'm not saying that we have the best government in the world, but I've seen other countries and we could be far, far worse off. That's all I have to say on that.
Yeah, we could also be far, far more better, a lot better off. More better. But no.
So there is a curfew coming down the pike that the Board of Supervisors wants to
involve me
for the county. This would be for...
They're going to go in their house and they're going to get fucking drunk and wasted. They're going to come out on the streets anyways. They're just going to, all it's going to do is not going to do anything because fucking kids are going to listen to it. It's going to cause more kids to come down here. They're going to be more rebellious than they already were.
Actually,
the most kids who are down here anyway aren't supposed to be down here in the first place.
Yeah.
Exactly. They don't have a house to go to.
I think that's an important point. Can you amplify that a little bit? You say kids don't have place to go to.
The homeless kids who hang out on that corner right there, they don't have any place to go after the curfew.
It's not just the homeless kids on the corner. It's all the kids. I mean, Santa Cruz really doesn't have anything around for people of the young age to get together. I mean, the curfew wouldn't involve me, but the whole thing is that it's like, first, the homeless people, they take away, they're not allowed to sit on the side. Well, where are they supposed to go sit?
You know, in Fresno, perhaps.
You know, yeah, well, what are they supposed to do? Get out of their town is basically what they're trying to do to them, and I don't think that's fair. They're people just like you and I.
Your name is?
James Manning.
James. So this curfew actually is coming down the pike, and it's a countywide curfew, but it will not apply to the city of Santa Cruz because Santa Cruz has rejected the idea. However, Santa Cruz is only a very small part of the county, so for many people, it will affect them. And from what I hear...
Capitola has a curfew, though.
Capitola has a curfew, as does Watsonville and Scotts Valley.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, we don't have a curfew. We're not going to have one?
No. Santa Cruz City will not, but the county will.
I'm set.
I still think it's stupid. I still think it's just fucking people trying to enforce laws on kids.
It's ridiculous.
You know, I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
I don't think it's fair to the young people. I mean, what are they supposed to do? There's nothing for them to go. I mean, all the places here are 21 or, you know, or older, unless there's a few given days. But, I mean, you can't just lock kids up in their house. All they're going to do now is get into more trouble. They're going to go out. If it's illegal, it's fun, right?
Yeah.
No? Underage drinking was the best, but as soon as you turn age, it's just not as fun anymore.
So they should make it criminal for all of us, so we gotta have a good time, right?
That's right.
What's new in town in the last year? Have there been any changes in terms of how you're treated, in terms of what your relations are with other people? Has anything happened in the last year that's different?
Like, a lot more people are becoming aware that there are young people out here who want to get out and do things, and a lot of my older friends have to hang out with people who are sometimes up to 40 years old, and so they're trying to get their shit together to maybe open, like, a place where it's, like, kids, you know, where kids can actually go somewhere at, like, 1 o'clock in the morning if they want to and hang out and see other kids and play video games or pool or, you know, do whatever. Not thinking about, like, you know, like an underage bar or anything, just somewhere where they can go and hang out.
There used to be such places like the Cafe Chameleon, the Cafe Culture, the Vertigo,
which is closed now. They just closed down the Casanova.
Is that right?
And that was where everybody went to play pool. I just moved out here from the East Coast. It's definitely very different out here.
Yeah, I've lived here all my life. You know, I've been hanging out in Santa Cruz for about 3 years.
Your name is?
Michelle, I'm up.
And Michelle, are you interested at all in, say, organizing people against the curfew?
Yeah, I'd like to get involved. I don't know about, like, leading anybody or, like, you know, actually putting my voice up. But, you know, I mean, I definitely think that it's a really stupid law that they're putting up. Because, I mean, kids are going to be kids. There's no way you can tell them to sit in their room and they're just going to sit in their room.
If there are young people who want to kind of join with you and, you know, fight this law, proposed law, that actually will be coming back to Board of Supervisors for the county on, I think it's February 13th. Do you have a number that they can call that I can put out over the air so they can reach you and offer to help?
And for those who do want to help fight this curfew, you can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll try to put you in touch with the young people who want to fight this curfew as well.
Youth have had their rights taken away on the streets and the schools, even in family situations. I can give you a call and talk to you about that?
Sure.
And you can then possibly, you know, at least keep kind of an archive of what's happening with some people in Santa Cruz.
I'll talk about this better.
Yeah, I guess. I think that'd be a pretty interesting thing to do. Yeah.
Hey, you heard it here first, Free Radio Santa Cruz. So, Michelle, you're saying that because you're kind of limited in your funds, you can't really afford to pay to call people back from the downtown area, which this pager number would attach you to, but when you get home...
And again, the number to call if you want to help publicize against the curfew, maybe staff a table on the mall to bring people's attention to the fact that it's coming before the Board of Supervisors, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, which is my number, and also the number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom.
Setting up a dating service immediately. I'm more concerned with people who have rights problems, and particularly people under the age of 18, or who have friends who are under the age of 18, or involved in groups of people who are under the age of 18. So give a call to Michelle, and she may be on the air on Monday, I guess, next Monday. What the date is going to be? Today is the 24th.
And Michelle didn't make it on the air, but if she's listening, give us a call. Maybe you can call in and talk to us on the air.
29th. Sounds like the 29th. So anything you want to conclude with, Audrey?
Well, I hope people call because it's a real interesting topic. And, you know, somebody needs to get some action going on here because this curfew thing is just not right. It's
Sure, and I was also, I think this other subject's been brought up about the lack of resources in town for folks who are young, and I think ongoing harassment of any sort, which I'd like to see, and also the perspective of how it looks, you know, from your point of view, which a lot of us have forgotten because we're so far past that age.
Yeah, a lot of people, I guess once they get older, they don't want to deal with kids having problems because they were kids once and they had problems too, and it's like, why go through that all over again if you don't have to? But there are some, like, rare exceptions to this, people who actually care that are over the age and actually, like, want to help out because they know what it's like and they remember what it's like to be a kid.
I also often do a lot of interviewing on issues that, in terms of sexual predatoriness. There's a lot of talk about how young people are getting, you know, shafted sexually here in town. Not a lot of talk. Some talk. Some scandal around it. Some of it's okay. But anyway, we'll talk more. Meaning, by shafted, I mean they get drawn into circumstances of, you know, where
definitely
they're abused, exploited by people who are...
That's a subject we know all about. Yeah.
Maybe you can talk about that at some point if you feel like you're able to do that. Yeah, well, tune in on Monday, folks, for that show, and also give a call to Michelle at 231.
And that's a brief interview with two or three young people. I guess they were 14, those young women, and the man was older. Again, opposing the curfew, and it's really hard to find people who don't. There are a few. Here's an article here in the San Jose Mercury News by Vincent Schiraldi, who is described as executive director of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice, an organization based in San Francisco and Washington. This today is Mercury News. And he talks about curfews. The head of the article, of course, says curfews don't work. In his recent State of the State address, California Governor Pete Wilson proposed what is fast becoming this year's crime control panacea, a statewide, and that would include Santa Cruz folks, juvenile curfew. The common sense logic behind curfew laws that kids ought to be off the streets at a decent hour and the government should do all it can to help in that regard seems irrefutable. In cities as diverse as Dallas and Detroit, Phoenix and Washington, D.C., juveniles now have government-imposed and enforced curfew laws. But if curfews are catching on, it's not because there's any evidence that they work. In fact, a survey of crime statistics in cities where curfews have been tried suggests they fall far short of expectations. In Detroit, a curfew was established in the wake of that city's infamous Devil's Night. Despite increased police presence and free cable television on Halloween, arsons in Detroit have virtually doubled from 223 in 1980.